From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, February 16, 2009. Venezuela's Hugo Chavez will be able to serve indefinitely after voters move to eliminate term limits. We'll go to Pakistan's tribal region, where U.S. drone attacks continue to claim civilian lives. And skilled immigrant workers can now fight their way to citizenship under a new Department of Defense program. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Transportation companies across Mexico are on strike today, calling on the government to lower diesel prices. Shannon Young has more.
The 24-hour strike affects public transportation and shipping in 22 Mexican states. Thousands of local and regional buses stayed off the streets today nationwide, forcing school closings in some areas. Here in the streets of Oaxaca City, taxis are doing brisk business, and some private citizens have taken over popular bus routes with their pickup trucks. The strikers are calling on the government to reduce and freeze the price of diesel at the equivalent of $1.65 a gallon. Prices have gone up by 34 cents a gallon over the past 12 months. All gasoline and diesel sold in Mexico comes from the state-run oil monopoly Pemex, and prices are subject to government control. Some companies with concessions to operate city buses have hinted that fares could more than double if the price of diesel doesn't drop. Transportation companies are threatening to start a 48-hour strike on Wednesday if authorities do not respond favorably to their demands by tonight. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
The United States rolled back yet another Bush policy today, calling on the international community to lower mercury levels in the environment and calling the element the most important global chemical issue of the day. Daniel Reifsnyder, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Environment and Sustainable Development, attended an environmental summit in Kenya today and called for immediate action. The toxic metal is used in chemical manufacturing and small-scale mining and can cause damage to the central nervous system. Last Friday, a federal appeals court decided that mine operators do not have to conduct more thorough environmental reviews of mountaintop removal projects. Almost immediately, Massey Energy began blasting on Coal River Mountain in West Virginia. When work crews returned to the site this morning, they were met by members of Climate Ground Zero, who blocked heavy equipment in protest of further mountaintop destruction. Two protesters were arrested and charged with criminal trespass, including Mike Roselle, Mountaintop Removal Campaign Coordinator.
That blast was Massey's response to their victory in the Fourth Circuit decision. Clear and simple. It was extremely loud, and I probably exceeded any allowable amount of explosives that they're supposed to put in that hole. And most of the people that I know in this valley thought that that was just Massey telling everybody that this is what we're going to do, because they started immediately. So this morning, we went up there. We got up there about 9 o'clock. We made sure that everyone knew that we were nonviolent, that we were not going to move. And then we sat there for at least about an hour and a half until the sheriffs came up. The state police. And then we were arrested. We don't think we're guilty of any crime. We think Massey is guilty of violating all the environmental laws that we have in this country. There's just no way to justify the destruction of these mountains. And so hopefully we'll be able to argue in court and put Massey on trial, because whatever we did, it was not nearly as bad or as dangerous as what Massey is doing to these mountains right here, right now.
Roselle says protests at the Coal River Mountain Massey Energy site will continue until mining activities stop. Israel has taken control of 425 acres of West Bank land today, opening area for the possible construction of up to 2,500 settlement houses. And in the wake of Israel's recent attack on Gaza, Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad says that the government has started to make payments to citizens of Gaza whose homes were destroyed during the offensive. The payments are cash-strapping the government, though, and Fayyad says that's leaving them unable to provide paychecks to civil workers in both the Israeli-occupied West Bank and the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip. Government workers have declared a strike. February 14th is a day now noted on the neo-Nazi calendar, and not because it's Valentine's Day. It's also the day on which the bombing of Dresden by Allied forces in 1945 is remembered. This year, more than 6,000 far-right demonstrators marched through the city to commemorate the anniversary. Cinnamon Nepart has more from Berlin.
25,000 people, including refugees, were killed during the raids on Dresden and most of the city was destroyed. But Germany's neo-Nazis used this terrible event for their own propaganda purposes, depicting Germans as victims of the war. During Saturday's demonstration, deputy leader of the far-right National Democratic Party, Holger Apfel, described the bombing as a unique Holocaust perpetrated on the Germans. The neo-Nazis were outnumbered by over 10,000 counter-demonstrators from the far-left, Jewish groups and trade unions, along with members of opposition political parties, the Social Democrats, Greens and the Left Party, who protested against the neo-Nazi demonstration on Saturday. But this event highlights concern over far-right activity in Germany. With twice as many neo-Nazis as last year, Saturday's demonstration was one of the biggest since the war and has opened up fresh debate over what should be done to prevent the rise of the far-right in Germany. In Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Financial figures for Japan were released today showing their economy shrinking faster than it has in the past 35 years. The world's second largest economy dropped at what would be an almost 13% rate spread over a year. Japanese Economy Minister Kaoru Yosano says recovery is nowhere in sight. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Venezuela's Hugo Chavez was first elected to power 10 years ago and is now eligible to stay in power indefinitely after voters passed an amendment ending term limits Sunday. Chavez has redistributed the country's vast oil profits and has become a harsh critic of U.S. foreign policy. He says that Sunday's results are a mandate for socialism, but his critics say it's just another move toward dictatorship. This is the second time voters have been asked to decide whether to eliminate term limits, and Chavez obliged all of Venezuela's television stations to air numerous presidential speeches leading up to the vote. So, did voters cast their ballots for socialism or autocracy? We're joined on the line by James Suggett. He's a reporter for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. James, Chavez's supporters have been in the streets chanting, Chavez no se va, meaning Chavez isn't going anywhere, and he's not. He's basically already announced his candidacy for re-election in 2012. This does sort of remind people of Fidel Castro, sort of 20th century socialism. Is that what Venezuela might be looking towards now?
Well, that's a really good question that I think is on a lot of people's minds. I think that Venezuela is following a very distinct path, actually. In some ways, we could ask a more difficult question, which is how is Venezuela the same as Cuba? Because there's so many differences that I see. One is that this was a very plural election, and the elections, as far as anyone can tell, are going to continue being very plural. There's a very large and well-organized opposition here that includes a lot of different political parties with different ideas, from the Social Democrats to the Christian Democrats that are more conservative, and sort of the middle ground also. And the opposition is very active and very free to express their opinion as well, which I understand is not necessarily the case in Cuba. Also, what this amendment does is actually just take the term limits off of elected offices, which means that Chavez will be a candidate in 2012, but he will be a candidate among many other candidates, probably more than a dozen. And it will still be the Venezuelan people who decide directly. And in terms of the overall model of Venezuelan society, there's a very large private sector of the economy, which has actually experienced tremendous growth over the last 10 years since Chavez was elected. President Chavez and his supporters, they really support a stronger state role in the economy, but it is usually in their effort to lower social inequality, to lower poverty, to make basic social services more available to people, and it is much less of the entirely autocratically state-run way that we have seen in some other models of socialism of the 20th century. So I see this more as a triumph of the Venezuelan people who organize themselves massively over the last couple months to get out the vote, and less of a triumph for just one leader like Chavez or whoever else is going to be president.
But this is the second time that Chavez has asked voters to go to the polls on the same issue to eliminate term limits, and he certainly used media to air his presidential speeches. Does this add up to any kind of abuse of power leading up to this vote?
Well, no, I don't think it adds up to an abuse of power, mainly because this is the second time that the idea of lifting term limits on the presidency has been on a ballot, but it's actually been in two separate initiatives, which were quite distinct, and both of them were very much in line with the Constitution. Now, Venezuela has a constitution that was actually written by an elected assembly in the first year of Chavez's presidency in 1999, and then voted on in a national election, so it received a vast majority of the Venezuelans' votes. And so based on that constitution, the National Assembly has proposed on two occasions a reform and then now an amendment of the constitution. Now, the last time this was on the ballot, it was actually part of a much broader package that was much more complex. It would have set the groundwork for a pretty significant territorial reorganization that would have passed power from the traditional structure of municipalities and states onto new legislative bodies based in local communities, based in these organisms of political participation, which are called community councils. And it also would have included a massive expansion of social security services. In the language of the Constitution, it would have prohibited discrimination based on sexual orientation, and it had a lot of things in it that made it really complex. And I think that, combined with the relative weakness at the time of the Socialist Party, of Chavez's political party, they couldn't get out the vote on such a complex matter. That was in 2007. And now, this is just the amendment of the few articles that have to do with term limits. It's actually a much more straightforward question, and it's a question I think most Venezuelans, as we saw yesterday, 54% of them voted in favor of it. So there were two different initiatives.
Well, James, thanks for taking some time to speak with me today.
Well, thanks a lot for calling us up here in Venezuela.
James Sugit is a reporter for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You can hear our entire interview on our website, fsrn.org. Pakistan's government has inked a temporary truce with militants in the Swat Valley region. The pro-Taliban group will cease attacks in Swat. In exchange, Pakistan will introduce Islamic law into its judiciary system there. The ceasefire was announced just after the first of two U.S. aerial drone missile attacks struck Pakistan's tribal region this weekend. The pair of attacks claimed more than 60 lives. Residents there say most of those were civilians. FSRN's Puck Lowe reads for our correspondent in the region, Gabe Matthews.
After two major drone attacks in 3 days, people in the tribal areas of Pakistan anxiously look into the sky as planes speed overhead. Monday morning, a suspected U.S. drone attacked a hideout and recruitment center used by Taliban militants in Karam Agency, located in the northwestern part of Pakistan, on the Afghan border. Local officials say that the attack killed at least 32 people, including 7 civilians. The attack struck as thousands nearby were participating in a Shiite religious ceremony, paying respect to the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Nazir Khan is a local resident who lives a mile away from where the drones attacked.
This place was a famous camp used by militants. It was a rest point for all militants when they come and go to Afghanistan and other tribal areas. I heard 3 loud sounds, and then dust rose from the area. It was understood that it was a U.S. attack, as the militants used the area for their activities since long.
This attack comes on the heels of a confirmed U.S. drone strike that struck South Waziristan, a famous Taliban and Al-Qaeda hideout, last Saturday. That attack killed an estimated 27 civilians. Of those, local officials said that 3 were militants, and the bodies of 2 others were burned so badly they could not be identified. A local resident of South Waziristan spoke to FSRN on the condition of anonymity.
I heard the screaming and shouting of women and children after the attack last Saturday. Everybody's worried and afraid in their homes since the drone attacks. The children and women go inside the rooms as soon as they hear the dreadful sounds of drones. I assure you 100% that most of the dead people are civilians. Most of them are children and women.
The two latest attacks that began 3 days ago have been the most deadly yet. There have been more than 30 U.S. drone attacks in all, and three of them have happened since President Obama took office. Meanwhile, in the Swat Valley, local provincial leaders reached a truce with militants, says Arshad Abdullah, a provincial law minister of Northwest Frontier Province.
The federal, provincial government and stakeholders have agreed on establishing a Sharia law in Swat. Initially, a joint declaration will be signed for confidence building on each other in the presence of Chief Minister of the province. We want the religious leader, Sufi Muhammad, to support government in establishing peace throughout the provincially administered tribal area, and we will establish Sharia when the situation will become normal.
In response to the government's announcement, the militants released a Chinese engineer they had been holding hostage since August 2008. And they announced a 10-day peace agreement as a goodwill gesture. But some locals, like Shah Jahan Khan, a young tribal member, don't think the truce will last.
I'm sure the truce will end with failure because it is impossible to enforce true Sharia and law, while the militants will not accept less than that. U.S. is also not serious. The drone attacks targeted the leader of Pakistani Taliban, Commander Bey-Ullah Mehsud, home for the first time.
For FSRN, reading for Gabe Matthews in the tribal areas of Pakistan, this is Puck Lowe.
FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every day for more than 7 years. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. In Sri Lanka's war-torn region, the Red Cross has evacuated another 400 injured civilians to the northeast part of the island for medical treatment. Nearly 800 people have been evacuated so far by the Red Cross, and close to 40,000 have fled on their own as fighting continues between government troops and Tamil Tiger rebels. The United Nations is calling for both sides to refrain from fighting in areas with high civilian concentrations. FSRN's Pania Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
This is the third evacuation of patients from a makeshift hospital in the coastal village of Pudumathalan. It lies in the rebel territory, which has fast shrunk in the past few months in a military operation by the government. Humanitarian officials say life in the war zone is miserable and the area remains cut off from the other parts of the island nation. Dr. Thureraja Vardaraja is the Regional Director of Health Services in Pudumathalan Makeshift Hospital.
We are facing big problems. There are no adequate food, no water supply. There are no NGOs. There are no any helpers. The medicine also, they are facing big problems. We have only one hospital in the Mathalan for the 4 lakh people. We are receiving more than 100 casualties per day. I think more than 30 people are dying per day. Today also, heavy shelling in the Irinapal area. We received more than 85 casualties and more than 10 dead bodies also we received from those areas.
The rebels, known as Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam or the LTTE, are fighting for a separate state for minority ethnic Tamils, and the struggle has killed more than 70,000 people during the past 3 decades. The LTTE is now cornered in a pocket of land where thousands of civilians are also trapped. Heavy fighting is raging, and the International Red Cross has said hundreds of civilians have been killed. Pro-rebel sites are posting reports with photographs of scattered civilian bodies, blaming the government forces for firing indiscriminate artillery shells into civilian villages. But the government denies the charge and accuses the rebels of using the civilians as human shields to slow down the military push. The rebels, with a fast, shrinking territory, are determined to survive while the government is determined to eliminate. Critics say both parties are putting their militaristic agenda over protecting human lives. Dr. Jahan Pereira is the director of the National Peace Council.
This is a very tragic situation.
This is a very tragic situation. I think the greater responsibility in such a situation lies with the government. At this point, when it has won so much of the territories and only very little Tamil territories left, the government should, for the sake of the civilians, have talks with the LTTE and seek international assistance to get the rest of the people released.
The United Nations, the United States, and Britain have asked the Tigers to allow civilians to leave the conflict zone while also urging the Colombo government to declare a temporary truce. Both calls have been rejected. The Sri Lankan military says it is on the verge of victory, having boxed the remnants of the LTTE into a narrow strip of coastal jungle. About 37,000 people have fled the conflict zone, but global rights groups have also raised concerns that the government is holding refugees in prison-like conditions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiya Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Burma's largest pro-democracy party, the National League for Democracy, has launched a new campaign to demand the release of all political prisoners, including their pro-democracy leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. The campaign was launched over the weekend in Rangoon. However, Burmese refugees across the region are also joining the effort. In India, there are nearly 50,000 Burmese refugees and hundreds demonstrated in New Delhi to increase international pressure on Burma. Bismila Gilani has more.
After a brief pause, Burmese exiles in India are again bustling with political activism. A signature campaign has galvanized the refugee community into action, and hundreds of them gathered in New Delhi seeking release of political prisoners. Aung Chau Nai, the Western Division in charge of the National League for Democracy, or NLD, says this initiative will infuse a new life into their struggle for restoration of democracy.
This campaign is an important step at the juncture in our struggle, and six political parties are supporting this initiative taken by the NLD. We all strongly believe that the release of our leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and all other political prisoners at this point is critical for Burma to move ahead.
Burma has the longest serving dictatorship in the world today. Since 1962, a military junta has been ruling the country. The iconic freedom fighter and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi spent much of the last 19 years in jail or under house arrest. Along with her, 1,200 other grassroots organizers are in jails. But the Burmese activists say the number of pro-democracy prisoners increased in the recent months to more than 2,000. Aung Myomin is the director of the Thailand-based Human Rights Education Institute of Burma.
The number has been increasing recently because many of the young people got arrested, many of them being sentenced at least 65 years. Some of them has been sentenced for life imprisonment for their peaceful demonstration in September uprising.
We want democracy!
No less democracy!
We shall fight!
We shall win!
We shall fight!
We shall win!
In September 2007, Burma witnessed an uprising led by the Buddhist monks, but only to be crushed brutally. And in 2008 May, Cyclone Nargis hit the country, leaving behind a trail of devastation. Following the international pressure thereafter, the military rulers announced to hold general elections in 2010, which they say will be their roadmap to democracy. But Myomin says releasing all political prisoners should be the first step.
This is the very immediate action that the military regime should take. If they are really genuinely moving forward for democracy, this is the first step. All political prisoners in Burma must be released.
The NLD hopes to collect about 90 million signatures throughout the world till August this year. In India, they are approaching parliamentarians, intellectuals and NGOs besides the refugees. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. U.S. military is launching a new program to recruit temporary immigrants into the military. The reward? U.S. citizenship. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, this is one of several new tactics being used to fulfill military requirements.
For years, the U.S. military has invited immigrants with green cards to enlist in the armed services. But now, the front lines in places like Iraq and Afghanistan might also include people in the U.S. on temporary visas. According to the New York Times, the Department of Defense is launching a year-long pilot program that will take place in New York City. It will target those with skills to be interpreters and medics. Spanish speakers are not allowed. The program says volunteers are guaranteed citizenship within 6 months.
Military recruiters have been basically lying to immigrants for many years, claiming that the military was a surefire way to citizenship. So for the first thing that jumped out to me was like, wow, you know, that's no longer a complete lie at least.
Jeff Patterson served in the first Gulf War and now runs the group Courage to Resist, which supports soldiers who decide they no longer support the mission of Iraq and Afghanistan. Patterson also says this is a sign that the military is in desperate need of recruits.
The military has continued shifting their enlistment requirements in order to meet their target recruitment levels. Back in the 90s, you had to be a high school graduate. You couldn't be a convicted felon. And that was a pretty hard line that you couldn't get away with crossing.
Such waivers became more common after dismal recruiting levels in 2005. About 5% of enlistees have felony records, and about 20% have not completed high school. Although military recruiters say recruitment has met goals in 2008, many experts expect it to pick up even more in a sour economy. Professor Aaron Belkin at the University of California, Santa Barbara, asks a question that sweeps across the U.S. policy spectrum.
Why is it that the military can unproblematically offer citizenship when it needs skilled personnel, when we don't offer the same rights to people, to temporary immigrants who become teachers or rape crisis counselors or trash collectors or anything else?
Some opponents say this new immigrant recruiting measure opens the door for terrorists to infiltrate the U.S. military. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by emailing us at comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.